Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
You're listening to the Talking Metal Podcast with your host, Mark Striegel, and special guest co-host, Victor M. Ruiz. iTunes number one hard rock and metal podcast. I'm Bud Friendly. Now, here are your hosts, Mark and Victor.
Welcome, one and all, to another episode of Talking Metal Live. I'm Victor over here in Spain, and 3,000 miles away, we have Mark Striegel.
Hey, yeah, Mark in New Jersey. How you guys doing tonight?
Hanging in there. Looking forward to another fun show, working on fumes at this moment. 23 straight hours awake, but all for the love of the show.
Why is that, Victor? 23 straight hours. Why?
23 straight hours. I mentioned during last week's show that I had what's referred to in the States as the stomach flu. I looked it up. We were lucky enough for me to have it and my kids to have it, and they've been very irritable this week. And they've been up since the crack of dawn today, trading off. I'd like to think that it's like Halford and Dickinson and The One You Love to Hate, where they're trading screams back and forth.
Just because they're so uncomfortable with the stomach flu?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, sorry to hear that, man. It sucks.
So I've got another few days left of that. It took me about 8 days to get rid of it, so I have about three more to hang in there, but such is life, I guess.
You said 3 days it took you to get rid of it?
It took me 8 days to get rid of it.
8 days?
Yeah. Yeah, it can go 8 to 10 days, and they've already been they caught on. My youngest son caught on about a week after I did, and my oldest son caught on like 5 days after I did. So
this is like vomiting and fevers and stuff like that?
Actually, that's the thing. I was reading online that although it's referred to as the stomach flu, it doesn't necessarily have to be exactly like the flu, where fever isn't common unless it's unless you have a bacterial strain of the stomach flu, and actually the nausea accompanies that. If it's just a regular stomach flu, it's just an infection in your intestine. And I'm saying just, it's still a pain in the ass because you're, you know, with stomach cramps and running to the bathroom every 2 seconds.
Yeah, well, I hope your boys feel better soon, because that's just miserable. And it sucks that they're sick, but it's like, as you know, when your kids are sick, it's like you're mentally sick. You just can't focus or do anything. So my best to your family, and let's hope for a quick recovery. I'm sure everybody will be fine real soon.
Yeah, I'm sure as well. And I also want to, this weekend, up in Lake Placid. So,
oh, sweet. My dad is in Lake Placid right now. He might even be listening right now.
Huh, no kidding. Yeah, this is the second time my brother's doing the Ironman up there. He did it a few years ago. And he's actually, I guess it takes place on Sunday.
So. Yeah, my dad actually hates it when they have the Ironman, because he's up there like he's up there quite a bit for right. most of the summer. And, you know, it's like the town kind of gets real busy, and it's a right. very, you know, kind of quiet place, mountain town, beautiful lakes and trees and mountains. And then it gets real busy for the Ironman.
Right.
So some of the people, you know, who are up there for long periods of time don't actually like it. However, it is great for the economy up there. And I know the town really depends on, you know, skiing in the winter and right. Ironman in the summer. So awesome. Your brother must be in good shape, obviously.
I think he would like to think so. He's in much better shape than I am. I have to say that he actually took up doing the triathlons after he turned 40. So it was something that he wanted to do to try to stay in shape. I mean, he's always, you know, cycled and done stuff like that. But then he decided, you know, I guess that as he got older, that he wanted to make sure that he stayed in shape and that he didn't have any type of physical issues. So he started doing the triathlons and he's loved it.
Right on. And speaking of Iron Man or Iron Men or Iron Man, the song, whatever, I'm trying to somehow segue into Black Sabbath. Black Sabbath played their first show of the tour last night, I believe, in right. Texas. And no one really seemed sure who was going to be on drums, although I guess people were assuming it was going to be Tommy Clefetis, right. and it was Tommy. So kind of interesting that, you know, at least it sounds like Ozzy, along with Tony and Geezer, had kind of pegged Tommy to do the record with them. And then right. when they brought Rick Rubin in to produce it, he insisted on another drummer.
Right.
And from what, you know, the little bit, if you kind of read between the lines, especially in the interviews with Ozzy, I don't think he was all that happy about that. So I guess it's no surprise that now that the album is done and they are out on tour, Tommy is back in the band. We know Tommy. He was on Talking Metal probably a couple years ago at this point. Right. And also we know him, of course, from his days touring and playing with Ozzy. Seems like an awfully nice guy, younger guy, at least younger than me, and he played with Rob Zombie beforehand.
And Alice Cooper and Ted Nugent. Yeah. And
correct.
I mean, he's been playing. I don't remember if he mentioned it in the interview with you or if I'd read it somewhere else, that he's been playing professionally since he was like 14 years old, that his dad was a drummer before him, and I guess similar to the Van Halen brothers. His dad would bring him out during shows and have him do like different drum solos or play different songs. And it surprised me that they went with the guy from Rage Against the Machine. I forget his first name. Actually, it's Brad Wilkes. I guess the whole deal there was Rick Rubin wanted someone he could depend on, and he knew, you know, how the guy worked. And he came out and said something that Tommy was too metal and they wanted to sort of reproduce what Sabbath did in the 70s and that Bill Ward wasn't a metal player. I don't know. And I guess I email where he didn't really call him up or like run it past anyone else. He just sent them an email and said, you know, sort of like your services aren't needed for the album.
Right. Yeah, that sucks.
So the funny thing is Ozzy keeps mentioning now how he'd like to have Bill work on the next album. He's already said, as recent as a week or two ago, that this shouldn't be the last Sabbath album, that they had a blast recording it and that they expect to possibly do another one. So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. You know, I could maybe see them doing another record. I would think if they do, I kind of doubt Rick Rubin's going to be involved, but who knows? We'll see. Sabbath is out there touring. I'm going to see them next weekend, a little over a week from the day we are doing this live show, which is, what is today's date? The 26th. So let's get into some new music here, Victor, and
sure.
come back and talk with the fans on Twitter and whatnot. But first, yeah, let's check in with Twitter actually right now. Chiaki from the Metal Moment podcast just tweeted 6 minutes ago. He said, it's called Vic's Jet Lagged. What does that mean?
Huh?
It's called Vic's Jet Lagged. Not sure what that means.
Yeah, me neither.
He says view conversation. Let me see. Oh, yeah. Talking Metal Live tonight with Victor and Mark. Yeah, so he said it's called Vic's Jet Lagged. I don't know what that means, Chiaki, but thanks for the tweet. And we have, of course, Todd checking in. Absolutely. He says, already tuned in, just waiting for you, man. Man, Todd is the best. He's here every Friday night with us. Todd, thank you so much for checking in with Talking Metal. And, of course, the this mystery guy, he has the two hearts in his Twitter handle. I love Tila. I'd love to hear, dude, what that means. You are a big supporter of us on Twitter. I love Tila. What's the meaning behind I love Tila? And again, tweet us at Talking Metal, or Victor has his own handle, which you have a couple handles, right? What Twitter handle do you prefer people hit you up at, Victor?
It doesn't matter. Whichever the two is easiest for them.
Give us one.
Sure. VMR907. We'll go with that one for tonight.
Cool. And a quick look at the charts. I'm just trying to mix it up a little bit here.
Sure.
Let's see. Top 20 on Liquid Metal, Sirius, Channel 40. These are the top three records. The Dillinger Escape Plan at number two with One of Us is the Killer. Philip H. Anselmo at number two, Walk Through Exit Only, and Black Sabbath 13 at number one. Over on Octane, which is channel 37, we have at number three Device, we have number two Volbeat, and we have number one Five Finger Death Punch with their album The Wrong Side of Heaven Volume 1. John Astronomy, my co-host here normally on Talking Metal, actually did some jamming, I swear to you on my life, with the guy from Five Finger Death Punch earlier this week.
Jason Hook, right?
Yes, Jason Hook. Bill from Mastodon was also at the jam, and Ace. And it was like some kind of Gibson, private Gibson meeting for like investors or something like that. Huh. And John hosted the night, kind of like the panel host, if you will, at this event. So cool for John. He got to sit down behind the drums while those guys jammed out some blues, he tells me. And there's pictures of that on John's Facebook page, actually.
And Jason, another former member of Alice Cooper's band.
Oh, really? Cool. Did not know that. Like to mention a podcast I recently started listening to, Joey's Rock Strikes 10. At rockstrikes10.cnjradio.com. Do you know this? You know this guy, Joey?
I do not, actually.
Yeah, you got to check this guy's show out. He's good, and I know he's been doing it for a while, and we've been friends, Joey and I, on Facebook, and I only recently started listening, and he does a great show. Anybody who plays Slayer and the Beach Boys in the same episode of a podcast has won my vote, and it's a good show. If all you like is heavy metal or rock, hard rock, you're not going to like Joey's show. If you got an open mind and you like good music, check it out. You know what drives me crazy on Facebook and stuff when I say, you know, I like this record or I like that record, and some of you Talking Metal fans will check in and like, are you kidding? It's like, no, dude, I listen to all different kinds of music. There's a lot of great music out there. It's not just all heavy metal and hard rock. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of real bad heavy metal and hard rock too.
I agree. But,
you know, so you just got to listen to what's good and what you think is good, you know, and, you know, don't feel like you only can listen to stuff in one certain genre. Cause I noticed that among a lot of different people, especially metal fans, where they just feel they can't even admit that they like anything outside of the hard rock or heavy metal genre. So open your minds, check out Joey's Rock Strikes 10 podcast.
It's one of those things where I guess a lot of these people double take and they look to the left and the right, see who's next to them before they can admit if they like something. But online, you know, they can't lose their metal cred.
Slayer is great. The Beach Boys are great, you know, and that's what I like about Rock Strikes 10, the Rock Strikes 10 podcast. A lot of good shit. Definitely check it out. And I wanted to mention I met the number one king of all podcasters. Adam Carolla was in the town next to me selling his Mangria wine. I went and I met him, got a picture with him, which I'll put in today's show notes in the podcast version of this, and got the bottle signed. I meant to drink it tonight and I forgot, but I'm drinking a Heineken. Were you drinking anything? You still off the booze, trying to get well?
Yeah, just I don't want to get ahead of myself here. Still drinking the Gatorade.
Okay. All right, cool. And what else was I going to say? Oh, yeah, Corolla, the biggest, the most downloaded podcaster out there. And, you know, he has the Corolla Digital Network, which we kind of ripped off the name. We now have the Talking Metal Digital Network. That's my fucking dog. Shut up. Talking Metal Digital is a direct ripoff of Adam Corolla or Corolla Digital. So there you go. Let's get into some music. I'm really digging the new Winery Dogs record featuring Kotzen, Portnoy, and Sheehan. Very, very strong record. You got something queued up there you want to hit, Victor?
Yeah, we have the track We Are One off of the album. And let's check that out. Checked out some. I almost said Mr. Big. We were talking about Mr. Big off air because of the whole Richie Kotzen.
Yeah, Richie Kotzen, of course, has a history with Billy Sheehan in Mr. Big, we were talking about. And Richie even briefly played in Poison, did a record with them. And the rumor was he was thrown out for sleeping with Bobby Dahl's girlfriend or something. I don't know if that's true. That was a pretty big rumor back in the day. Who knows? But Richie Kotzen, what a talent that guy is. And so many people just don't know about him.
Right. Yeah, a guy that, like I was saying off air, was considered a big-time shredder way back when, and when it became uncool to solo and all that. And when a lot of these guitars sort of went underground, he sort of, you know, he joined Poison initially, and then when he came back out, sort of started doing, you know, hard rock mixed in with a lot of blues and even some country flavored stuff. So definitely has a lot of talent.
And just an amazing voice. I mean, like a Chris Cornell almost style voice, you know, so it's so good. So good.
Cool. So I wanted to touch upon the Vivian Campbell interview that you did, because it did receive a lot of different press from various sites. A lot of sites reprinted part of the interview, and of course you always have people chiming in, and it's interesting to see some of the remarks. It amazes me that after listening to that interview, and I'm guessing that most of the people that commented didn't listen to the interview, because I think for years maybe a lot of people sided with Dio and thought, you know, well, Vivian was just bitter or whatnot, just because some of the comments that had been going on back and forth, and he sort of didn't want to talk about those years. But I think after listening to the interview, you could really tell that he was hurt by the situation. You know, it didn't seem like, you know, he wanted to be in that situation. It seemed as if almost that after Dio died, that there was almost like a weight lifted off of him.
Yeah. You know, he said some terrible things, and I think he's admitted that. And I have seen in the past with other bands, like, you know, even Kiss, for example, where they really, when they took the makeup off and they got into the 80s, guys, you have to remember that platforms and bell bottoms and anything 1970s was dorky, you know. So it's interesting that Kiss, for the longest time, there was like, not for the longest time, but for a number of years, they only were playing like three, four, maybe five songs from 70s era Kiss in their set list and everything. Right. You know, if you look at that Animalize tour, they were barely playing any old songs. You know, yeah, sure, Detroit Rock City, Rock and Roll All Night, maybe Black Diamond, maybe one other, you know, but it was like hardly anything until, and they even changed, they changed the cover of Creatures of the Night because they didn't want the makeup on there because they thought that that would hurt it, you know, and they put Bruce Kulick on the cover and the non-makeup era Kiss on the cover of Creatures of the Night, only later, many years later, to re-release it with the original makeup, right, album cover. And, you know, so sometimes you need to separate yourself from the past. And yeah, I've seen this with Robert Plant too, and many bands. You need to kind of separate yourself from the past for a decade or so until you can re-embrace it. Now, with Vivian, it obviously had been much more than a decade. And I do think it's because of, you know, his anger towards Ronnie and or Wendy or both. And maybe, you know, like I speculated before, he didn't want to give it any props at all, because it's very possible he's not getting any money off of it. He may have signed away all performance rights and songwriting rights, and he just, maybe it was just too painful for him to admit to it being great. Although you have to think, maybe down deep he still did maybe think that, or I who knows what the fuck happened, you know. Right. I remember Eddie Trunk talking about it, and Eddie was the first guy I heard talk about Vivian, and he said, you know, he spoke to Vivian, and Vivian wanted, this is like probably 2-3 years ago, I remember Eddie saying that Vivian was you know, almost upset that the metal community wasn't digging him, and who knows? So maybe Eddie Trunk planted the seed with him that, you know, what you did was great, and you know you should embrace the fans who like that, the music you did with Dio. I don't know.
Yeah, that could be the case. You know, who knows? It could be, as you're saying, you know, such a painful situation that he had it buried in the back of his mind, and, you know, with enough people, I don't know, trying to give him a proverbial kick in the ass to go check the stuff out and maybe light that spark again, I guess he went back and finally did it. It's interesting that during the interview you did as well, he credited playing with the guys from Thin Lizzy to sort of, you know, get his blood going again, to wanting to do more guitar oriented playing. And for about 2 years, I guess there were sort of rumblings about him not doing enough in Def Leppard, and yeah, you know, so
he's probably a paid employee in Def Leppard.
Oh yeah, without a doubt.
And, you know, I think he's careful. If you listen to the interview, first of all, I did transcribe most of the interview.
Right.
And I do think that if you listen to it and you hear the tone of his voice, sometimes reading, it's like you get an email from somebody and you can't tell the tone. Talks pretty passionately about his time in Dio.
Yep.
Even going into detail about the hearing aid project and the recording of Last in Line, and it, you know, it's a good listen to any fan of early 80s heavy metal. And I do think that there's something to be said about these interviews that you get on podcasts like that one, for example, where you just can't read these. You got to hear the inflection of the voice. You got to hear the sincerity, or for that matter, lack of sincerity. And that's why I think, if you are a fan, go listen to it. And I'll tell you, a lot of people did listen to it, though, because we got a shitload of downloads. That episode really was a big one for us on Talking Metal.
Yeah, I agree. A lot of times when I have people on Mars Attacks that are, you know, where there are things written up, Michael Kiske from Helloween is one that comes to mind, where there are so many things written that were negative towards him. You have the person on, and as you're saying, you hear their voice, you hear their story, you hear them explain things, and it really gives you a different side of, you know, a story. And it isn't some, you know, guy in print. Obviously, you're not trying to make a name for yourself. You've professed to loving Dio and loving Vivian's work and everything else. And a lot of times, you know, when I interview people, for the most part, I would say 99.9% of the people that I interview, I'm fans of their work as well. So, I mean, I really want to get, you know, a story out of them. But at the same time, I don't want to, you know, cook up some gossip where a lot of times you have, you know, people in print that on the one side you could sort of, you know, take some of the things that are written up one way or another, like you're saying. And at the same time, you know, they can even transcribe that and truncate it and do whatever to make it sound even worse than what it is. So with a podcast format, you know, you're hearing someone speak, you're hearing exactly what they want to get across.
Definitely. Cool. In the email, you mentioned something about a rumor that Vivian had tried out for Ozzy or something?
Yes, okay.
Well, that's obviously not true, because I wanted to say that in the interview I did with him, he said he's never met Ozzy Osbourne.
And that's exactly why I wrote it down. That was one of the big interview or one of the big rumors back in the day, that Ozzy was considering hiring him. And actually, there was a rumor that Jake was offered the spot in Dio as well.
Yeah, I don't think the thing with Jake is a rumor. I think that's pretty clear. I know even in Stephen Piercy's book, he says that Jake basically left Rat to go join Dio's band.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, and I do remember there was actually an interview back when Jake was doing Badlands. It was like him and Dio, like in the listening studio, and like guitar for the practicing musician.
Right.
And there was, I think they were talking a little bit about their history in that. But yeah, I'm fairly certain Jake Ely, according to numerous different sources, was considered for Dio's band and was, you know, close to working with Dio. If maybe it's possible that he even was working with Dio.
And that's interesting. He would actually be the first of two Rat guitarists that had involvement in Dio. Because now that I remember, after Doug Aldridge left the band, they actually brought Warren DeMartini in and tried him out. And apparently, a month after bringing him in, he was fired because they said he wasn't doing a good enough job of recreating a lot of the solos.
Hmm.
So it's... I didn't remember that the other week when you discussed the Stephen Piercy. It just came to mind now, but it's interesting how a lot of these bands, you know, how it's such small circles. You know, you talk to Jeff Pilson, and Vivian talks about, you know, running into Jeff as well and talking to him and knowing him from the Dokken days as well. the singer that they have in Last in Line also worked with George Lynch for a while there in Lynch Mob. So it's interesting how all of this is almost like that old thing, 6 degrees of separation to Kevin Bacon. You know, it's almost like 6 degrees to separation in this case from Jeff Pilson.
Yeah, no, totally, totally. Cool. Well, you want to get into a little stand up and shout and then come back and talk about the 90s.
Yeah, let's do that. And the reason that I picked stand up and shout is because I think for a lot of people, that was the first song that they heard Vivian play on. I mean, unless they were listening to Sweet Savage.
Right.
You know, that was their introduction to Vivian Campbell. So let's jump on that track. Stand up and shout there from Dio. And the next topic that I sort of threw out there to discuss was 90s hard rock and metal, something that I think gets somewhat of a bad rap from people. I think that similar to what you were saying about Kiss and how, you know, when you got to the 80s, the 70s stuff wasn't cool anymore. When you got to the 90s, you definitely noticed that, you know, MTV was trashing a lot of 80s bands. They couldn't get any airplay on radio.
Right.
You know, so I think a lot of fans of hard rock and metal sort of, you know, automatically panned that decade as saying that nothing good came out. But I think quite the opposite. You know, I think that there were a lot of really good albums that did come out and a lot of, you know, influential bands. I remember interviewing Rex Brown, and that was one of the things that I asked him. I said, you know, so many people say the 90s metal sucks. You know, your band, Pantera, essentially built their fan base and became as popular as they are during the 90s. So what do you have, you know, what's your take on that? And he essentially said that, you know, he thought that whole thing was stupid, that, you know, exactly what I had said was correct, that Pantera in their, you know, formative years, it was all throughout the 90s, and that so many other bands had put out great albums as well.
Yeah. And you know, it's back to kind of what we were talking about earlier, where people just like can't see out of their own little box that they live in. You know, it's like,
right,
there's so much good music. And I mean, you know, it's back to the definition of what is metal. I mean, if you know, the first couple Black Sabbath records are considered metal, which they are, then Alice in Chains' Dirt is metal too, you know, and it's right. Like, that's a great album from the 90s, you know, and then it's like, well, then is Soundgarden metal? Yeah, some of it is, you know, and it's like, so there's a lot of great stuff. Now, you know, I guess for me personally, just my own personal memories of the 90s are, you know, I do remember that suddenly metal wasn't real cool anymore. And I remember it starting before the 90s. I mean, you know, it drives me crazy when people are like, you know, Nirvana was what killed metal. And that's such a fucking dumb bullshit statement. It's like there wasn't, you know, when MTV played Smells Like Teen Spirit for the first time, it wasn't metal. That's just not the case. Heavy metal had been, you know, changing and dying, and traditional metal had been changing and dying and evolving. You know, I remember bands like, you know, Living Color and then seeing Fishbone play with Living Color, and you know, Fishbone was had heavy sounding guitars on that second record, Truth or Soul, and you know, the heavy guitars were suddenly being used in different types of music. I'm not saying Fishbone was metal, but they had certain sounds that came from metal. You know, things just evolved. And of course, Pantera, yeah, I mean, that doesn't get any more metal than that. But that was an evolvement too. That was like, they really took these extreme metal sounds and in some ways brought them to the mainstream, or at least close to the mainstream, you know. So I think metal was definitely alive and well in the 90s, just in a lot of different forms. And yeah, Iron Maiden and Dio were no longer filling arenas in the 90s. You know, I remember Maiden, you know, was playing, you know, larger theaters and stuff like that. And but as you sent, you know, as you mentioned in the email we were thrown around earlier, Victor, there's a lot of great stuff that came out in the 90s. Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at your email, the Chemical Wedding record by Bruce Dickinson. Oh my God, that's a great record. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, I agree. And I actually prefer the one that came out before that, Accident of Birth, which was a monster album as well. I mean, out of this whole list. And what I did was I went to Martin Popoff's list of top 500 metal albums and picked out the first 10 albums that actually came out in the 90s.
And yes.
Essentially, you want me to read the albums off?
Yeah, sure. Or I actually, right here in front of me, why don't you go ahead, and then okay. I have his top 10 metal records from the 90s too.
Okay.
But go ahead, read those first.
Okay, so at number 11, you have Megadeth's Rust in Peace. Number 20 is Pantera's Far Beyond Driven. Number 26, Judas Priest, Painkiller. Number 27, Metallica, the self-titled Black Album. Number 28 is Slayer, Seasons in the Abyss. Number 47 is Dream Theater, Images and Words. 52 is Alice in Chains' Dirt. 61 is Bruce Dickinson's The Chemical Wedding. 66 is Carcass's Heartwork. And 67 is Sepultura's Arise.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, his top 10 here. Actually, let's take it back. Top 20 of this is just his top 20 hard heavy metal records from the 90s, hard rock, heavy metal. 20, The Tea Party, The Edges of Twilight. What the fuck is that?
The Tea Party, that's actually a Canadian band that when I interviewed Gene Hoagland, he mentioned that if I was into that Zeppelin-y, like Arabian sound, or however you want to mention it, like the Kashmir type deal, to check out the Tea Party, because a lot of their music was like that. And I didn't, you know who the Tea Party was up until about 2 years ago, but that's a Canadian band that I'm sure Mark.
Number 18, Danzig 4. Number 17, Megadeth, Rust in Peace. Number 16, a favorite of mine, Love Hate, Blackout in a Red Room.
Huh.
12, oh, another great one, Paw, Dragline. Do you remember that band, Paw?
I remember the band. I remember the album cover, but I don't remember any of the tracks.
Oh, great. They had a song called Jesse. Oh, a great, great band. Paw were like a grunge band.
Right.
But like really aggressive and loud. And, you know, again, it's that fine line of what is metal, what's right. not. But Paw were, they were a little too like hard rock to be in with the Seattle grunge scene, you know, okay. But they definitely were grungy, but like hard rock, great band, highly recommended. That reminds me, I got to pull that CD out and start listening to it. 15, he's got down Pantera, Far Beyond Driven. 13, another Love Hate record, Let's Rumble. 12, Seasons in the Abyss by Slayer. 11, Tapehead by King's X. At number 10, When the Burrow Breaks by Black Sabbath drummer Bill Ward. 9, a great, great record, Abandoned by Deep Purple. I love that record. 8, he's got Burning Time by Last Crack. Wow, I'm embarrassed to say I don't know that record. Do you?
I do know that record.
Yeah.
Last Crack was this, before there was Tool, there was Last Crack. They're a band from the middle of nowhere in Kansas that put out this really weird, like art rock metal progressive album. They put out two albums, and right. I think I had the first one on vinyl, and I definitely had the second one on CD. And I know that, for example, Slipknot's drummer Joey Jordison really talks them up and says how they're really out there and how he really enjoyed their music, and he actually singled them out as one of his favorite Roadrunner bands.
Interesting. Number 7, Martin Popoff has the number 7 record of the 1990s as Dogma by King's X.
Okay.
Number 6, Trouble by Trouble. Number 5, The Human Factor by Metal Church. Number 4, guys, this is Martin Popoff's third Love Hate record in the top 20 from the 1990s of the best hard rock heavy metal records. He has Wasted in America. At number 3, he has Perpendicular by Deep Purple. Number 2, Manic Frustration by Trouble. And at number 1, ZZ Top. Rhythmine? Is that what it's called? Rhythmine?
Rhythmine.
What the fuck's on that record? Rhythmine. I don't even know that record. We were talking about that off air, Victor, and you told me Billy Sheehan mentioned that in the interview that I did with him. I don't remember that either.
He said something to the extent of that being a very heavy album and how ZZ Top doesn't get enough credit for influencing hard rock and metal. And he pointed, you know, to that album. And it's funny because I almost just choked on the Gatorade when you read that. And I knew it was coming, but I forgot, because the first thing that came to mind was, and the Grammy goes to Jethro Tull.
Right.
You know, sure. I mean, it's obvious that ZZ Top has had to have some sort of influence on hard rock and metal, but to be the best album of the 90s, I don't know.
You know, follow any trends at all. He's got his own voice, and sometimes his stuff is a little surprising. So there you go. Martin, by the way, has a great book called The Collector's Guide to Heavy Metal. And there are actually numerous editions of this, The Collector's Guide to Heavy Metal. And the list that I just read you guys came from Volume 3, the 90s. I actually have Volume 1, the 70s. I have Volume 2, the 80s. And Volume 3, the 90s. I need to do a little more reading of this one. I've pretty much been through the 70s and 80s volume over and over again. But I will admit, I'm not a expert on 90s metal, and I need to definitely explore that decade a little more, because I know there was a lot of great stuff that happened in the 1990s on the more underground level with heavy metal, especially like power metal and stuff. Wouldn't you agree, Victor?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it was really a decade where a lot of chances were taken as well, where, as you're saying, there was really a fine line between, you know, what was metal, what wasn't, what was grunge, what wasn't. You had bands like Testament, for example, that were really experimenting, as you're saying, adding maybe a little bit more of a power metal influence, but at the same time, they were adding a death metal influence as well. So they were splitting off in two different directions. You had a lot of other bands that were, you know, unfortunately trying to jump on bandwagons, but a lot of these bands also, you know, were jumping on bandwagons when they first came out in the 80s as well. Similar to what you said, you know, Nirvana didn't come along and, you know, as Tom Petty said, become like a sickle and cut everyone down. What actually happened was there were too many crappy bands out there, and they were all, you know, just sort of copying one another. There was really no originality in what a lot of bands were doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, I liked Pretty Boy Floyd, and a lot of people hate him, but I liked them. But who I didn't like was like Firehouse, and I remember hearing them and just thinking, this is like, you know, if Motley Crue was like the first generation, you know, by the time we got to Firehouse, it was like fourth generation. Yeah. You know, it was just like, it seems stale at that time.
Right.
And it's interesting now with the age of the internet. I feel like different styles of music can kind of live on a little bit longer or just on their own. Whereas back in the 90s, the early 90s and the 80s, it's like, you know, there were only so many fanzines and there were only so many, you know, outlets for the music. And, you know, when things started turning, when people weren't buying it up like they used to, big business turned their heads on it maybe a little quicker than some fans would have liked, you know, and,
right.
And that, you know, if anything, you know, the fact that sales had started to decline just naturally, as far as heavy metal, you know, or especially like, you know, I hate the term, but hair metal or glam metal goes, right. Commercial metal, you know, sales were declining. And I think there were a lot of people who were still into it, even though sales were starting to decline. Big business turned their head on it, you know, and just kind of more money off. And, you know, independent music, whether you want to agree with me or not, which if you don't want to agree with me, I think you're probably wrong. But I just think independent music thrives a lot better now in the age of the internet.
Yeah, I agree with you, because exactly what you said, when a lot of these bands were thrown out back then, they had no place to go. If they were lucky, I mean, if you were Wasp, if you were Motorhead, if you were bands like these whose labels folded up or whose labels cut them loose, well, they were able to go to a Sanctuary Music or, you know, mm-hmm. Eagle Rock Entertainment, things like that. But other bands, a lot of the, you know, commercial metal bands, as you're saying, they had no place to go. Whereas today, you know, you could go to Bandcamp or you could, you know, self-release something and sell it via your website. And you have, you know, that outlet that they didn't have back then.
Yeah. Definitely.
I agree with you 100%.
I think the internet in general, especially for the music we love, you know, all forms of hard rock and heavy metal, has been probably a good thing. You know, yeah. I mean, people complain about it, you know, killing sales and stuff. But the flip side of that is it's allowed fans to stay in touch with their favorite bands. You know, look at Mike Tramp. It's like, for example, like my cousin is a big Mike Tramp fan, and she kind of, you know, hasn't been following White Lion or Mike Tramp for, you know, 15 years, but she was a hardcore fan 15, right. 20, 30, 25 years ago. And, you know, it's like now I've suddenly reintroduced her to, hey, Mike Tramp's actually out on tour. He's doing stuff. He's out there. He's making music. And she, through the magic of the internet, is now getting all excited about Mike Tramp again. And she's watching interviews with him and, you know, seeing what he's up to now. And it's like, if we didn't have the internet, you know, my cousin who, you know, isn't really tied into, you know, she's not hardcore enough where she'd be like going out and getting obscure fanzines and stuff mailed to her. But thanks to the internet, she's now interested in Mike Tramp and what he's up to now. And who knows, maybe she'll even, you know, throw him some cash to buy a song or to buy a t-shirt or maybe even go see a show, you know, when he comes through her town. So I think the internet is good for a lot of these guys, you know, and it helps them keep the fan base alive, even if the fan base is much smaller than it once was.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And you have so many bands, you know, releasing things directly through iTunes nowadays where they're getting a bigger percentage, and it's allowing them to do a lot of the stuff that you mentioned. And I think a lot of this does come back to what we discussed in the last episode, which was, you know, these big companies ripping off fans and a lot of the fans becoming jaded and also not wanting to support certain things. You see a lot of bands, and Anthrax comes to mind, and I absolutely love Anthrax. They're one of my favorite bands. But a lot of times they complain about illegal downloads and things of that nature, and they always point back to the 90s as sort of being the golden period. But if you look at it, the 90s is the only decade where there were multiple media formats. We started out with vinyl. They transitioned people over to cassette. When that wasn't good enough, they transitioned everyone over to CD. And by the end of the decade, people were on a medium where, you know, people actually didn't have to go out and rebuy things. You know, forget about illegal downloads. If you had the CDs, you just ripped them to MP3s. You know, it wasn't a case of, you know, so many people going out and you know, wanting to download. I mean, yes, Napster had a big thing to do with it. The culture had changed and whatnot. But at the same time,
and the labels, they just fought Napster instead of embracing it, you know, and like, you know, it's like... it's like we you know, I think we mentioned this in the last episode. It's like, you know, the days of charging these crazy prices. You know, I remember like as a kid, CDs going for $16.99. I mean, for a kid, that's a lot of freaking money in 1991. You know what I mean? It's like, it's like that's to pay for music. I mean, it's outrageous. It's outrageous. You know, and I don't know where I'm going with this, but I just think the labels were too greedy, you know, and the technology hurt the labels, but also greed did, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
I wanted to mention Mike checked in on Facebook, and he has said that 1990 through 1995 it was grunge, 1996 through 1999 new metal, and he says those were the two big genres in the 90s. That's true. New metal. We didn't even get into that. We should touch upon that maybe in another episode.
He's forgetting boy bands.
And boy bands. Yeah, I think he's just talking about that kind of hard rock, heavy metal stuff.
Yeah.
And I you know, a lot of people again will get mad at me for saying this, but I wasn't a new metal hater like all the others. I was there at some of the early Korn shows and saw Limp Bizkit, and you know, I would even include like Soulfly and some of that new metal. Oh, I mean, it depends what you want to classify as new metal, but I thought anything with loud guitars was cool, you know, and new metal was something I didn't embrace like I embraced heavy metal in the 80s, but I definitely enjoyed quite a bit of it. I mean, I like some of those first three Korn records. I like a lot, you know?
Yeah. I played Korn about an hour ago. So
like, cool. There you go.
I mean,
go ahead.
It's similar to what we were saying before. I don't have a problem with the first or second generation bands. It's that third, fourth, fifth generation band that is just ripping everyone off, wearing the, you know, the Adidas tracksuits just because it was the cool thing to do.
Right.
Those are the bands that ruined it, you know, similar to what happened with, you know, a lot of the bands trying to mimic the LA strip bands.
Yeah, totally. So Mantra. Oh, I think that's Bert Gabriel who checked in on Twitter, and he's commenting that I said Todd's the best, and He says, fuck Todd, I'm the best. I've been listening since 2005. Bert, everybody's the best. We love all you guys. No need to get nasty there. We love Todd, of course. He's always here with us on Friday night. And I know you're just goofing around, Bert. So Bert Gabriel, definitely long time Talking Metal listener. Glad you're with us tonight. Bert, glad you're with us. Todd just checked in again on Twitter saying, in 96, I saw LA Guns and Slaughter at a bar in Tioga, PA. I'm not sure if that's the Tioga. I don't know. Sorry. PA, less than 50 people. Bands fell hard and fast back then. It's true, man. It's true. I saw Slaughter, Vince Neil, and Warrant play a small club in Long TV. It was when I was working on a show called, it was a special called It Came from the 80s Part 2. Metal Goes Pop was the name of the special I was working on for MTV News. And we went out there and, you know, it was more than 50 people, but it's Long Island, but not a lot more, 200, 300 people in the club, which, those bands 5 years earlier were playing arenas,
Right.
So, it is interesting how quick things turned for a lot of these bands in the 90s.
Right. Well, didn't Maiden during the Blaze Bailey years play the Roseland in the city?
I was at that. It was a double bill. It was Dio and Maiden playing Roseland together. I mean, talk about two of the biggest metal bands of the 80s, and it was pretty packed. I don't know. I can't remember if it was sold out or not, but it was definitely filled. But the fact that they couldn't, I'm getting tired. That was my first yawn of the evening. the fact that they couldn't play a bigger place was interesting. But yeah, Dio and Maiden together on the same bill, if I'm remembering correctly, at Roseland. I was there with my friend Terry Kayamori.
So yeah, and that's in New York. Imagine in,
biggest city in the country.
Yeah, imagine in Milwaukee or Des Moines.
Really?
They're playing instead of. I mean, how many people fit in the Roseland?
I would need to Google it. I guess what 3,000 maybe. I don't know.
So let's say they had about 2 to 2,500. And yeah. Out in the sticks somewhere, they're probably pulling in a tenth of that.
Yeah, well, I remember hearing about even Bruce Kulick and John Corabi and Bruce Kulick,
yeah,
playing Buffalo, New York. Somebody I had known went and saw them there at some point. I'm not exactly sure of the year, but there was 30 people there,
Right,
and that was I think post Bruce's time in Kiss and
right.
Johnson and Motley Crue, but I mean that's 30 people, that's nothing,
I remember reading that the same two guys had played Allentown in Pennsylvania, and that they were asking people for requests because there was similar deal. There were 15 people in the crowd, and the reason that Union sort of fell apart was exactly because of that, because no one was going to see them play.
Yeah.
So, and actually, if they play today, they usually play under the Eric Singer Band logo.
Capacity of Roseland, by the way, I just Googled 3,200.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was pretty close. Other big news, by the way, just speaking of New York City venues, I've seen many great shows at Roseland through the years, as I have at Madison Square Garden. Yeah. I don't know if you heard this, but apparently the Garden has to move. Did you hear this?
Yeah, I'm a poster on a forum called Outside the Garden, which is a New York Rangers forum. And ever since my wife got me an iPad for Christmas, I'm signed up to I'd read the story initially that whatever council is in charge of not so much the Garden, but Penn Station and the surrounding area,
Right.
What they want to do is they feel that they're losing money because the Garden prohibits Penn Station from being a lot more similar to Grand Central Station, which is above ground, which has different type of access. But Penn Station is the busiest transportation hub in the country.
Wow.
So essentially what they're saying is they're losing all this money to not being able to have restaurants and different amenities that they could have. So what they want to do, or what they've actually approved, is that MSG has 10 years to move.
Right. Well,
what Jim Dolan, the owner of, or the guy that controls the Garden, the Knicks, the Rangers, Rockefeller Center, or not Rockefeller Center, Radio City, and I forget how
many. Cablevision.
Cablevision.
And he's got his own band. I could tell you some stories about Jim Dolan. I don't know if they're worth getting into right this minute, but
White Shoes. Yeah.
What's that?
Jimmy White Shoes Dolan is one of the nicknames. But anyway, he was looking.
I got lots of stories on him. That's another episode.
He was looking to have their stay, or however you want to call it, or their lease extended indefinitely. Mm-hmm. And someone else had brought up the previous lease was for 50 years and it's up this year. I guess the press release that the Cablevision people sent out was sort of nonchalant, and they pretty much said, well, you know, we're looking to finish the renovations of the Garden, which has cost them close to $1 billion. It's forced the Rangers to start two of the last three seasons on the road for about a month so that they could finish these renovations. They've, as a result, haven't been able to have any concerts during the summer either because they've been renovating the entire time. And what I've read online is what they have in their favor is that once these 10 years are up, a lot of the people that voted for them to move probably aren't going to be in office anymore. And it's probably going to be one of these deals where a lot of people are going to get voted into office because they're going to help preserve, you know, the Garden and the place where it's currently at, you know, the history that it has and everything else. Although,
oh, and he'll be making campaign donations to those people, and helping fund them to make sure they get into office. So what you're saying basically is there's a chance that after everything's said and done, it might not actually happen.
That it might not happen. I mean,
okay.
They had, remember, if they started this renovation 3 years ago. They were trying to get a new Garden built across the street where the post office is currently located.
Mm-hmm.
Because apparently down by the Javits Center, post office moved most of, I guess, what they had right across from the Garden. They moved almost everything down by the Javits Center. So that building is only like a quarter of it's being used currently. So they were trying to work things out so that they could move the Garden across the street. And then they could do whatever they wanted with, Penn Station. That fell through, and that's why they did this renovation. The other thing that they're saying that you can throw out there and say, okay, well, you know, you can build here. They're talking about building a new Garden down by where the Javits Center is because they've apparently built new subway lines down to there. There's one that's starting up this year, and there's another one that'll be in service in – I think 2 years, and they're saying that it'll have good enough access from Times Square and from Grand Central.
Is this the 7 train they're going to continue down over there?
Yeah, the 7 train.
Because there's talks of them actually continuing the 7 train to New Jersey, but I don't know if that'll ever happen.
Yeah, the 7 train, apparently, if what I read is correct, by the end of this year, it'll be all the way down to the Javits Center.
Right.
And there's apparently another train. I don't even remember what number it was, but they're saying that will supposedly go all the way down to the same area as well. So that'll help bring people to and from, you know, Penn and Grand Central and Times Square down to where the new Garden would be at. The biggest concern that they have is people's safety in that area, because that area isn't exactly populated, you know, like,
right, but it will be once they get the train down there, you know, stuff will gentrify and people will start moving there. But interesting stuff. And, you know, I guess we'll just have to wait and see if it ends up moving. It is interesting to note that Madison Square Garden was once at Madison Square Park, which is over by
Lincoln Center, I believe, isn't it?
No, it's Madison Square Park is down like by 23rd Street, like in Broadway, like in that area. Don't quote me on that, guys, but I'm pretty sure that that's what is Madison Square Park, you know, between, you know, Midtown and Union Square. There's a park that's called Madison Square Park, and that is where, you know, Madison Square Garden was originally, and I believe it moved over to the where Penn Station is, and they knocked down this beautiful train station and put the garden on top of it. And, you know, a lot of people still complain about that. But anyways, we're kind of off on a tangent here. New York history.
That's actually, by the way, the fifth garden. The current location is the fifth, because apparently dates back to the late 1800s. So, but I guess, you know, due to television and everything else, this is the garden that everyone, you know, remembers. There's still footage of the garden previous to this one. Obviously, this one, I believe, opened in the late 60s, if I'm not mistaken. So,
Madison Square Park is on Broadway and Madison Ave.
Okay. Yeah, I had a client.
Between Broadway and Madison Ave on East 23rd up to East 26th Street.
Had a client years ago. She was in the real estate sector, and she had us remove Madison Square Park from her project, from the map that she had bought from my company, because she said it had no relevance to what she was doing and that nobody ever referenced that park. So go figure.
They don't very often, but yeah. Anyways, dude, I got to wrap it up here. I'm kind of fading, and I'm sure you are too if you've been up for like 24 hours.
Been up for 24 hours and 15 minutes.
Yikes.
So
thank you for planning the show out, Victor, and producing it. We're going to hopefully get it up in podcast form. Talking Metal episode 422. If you missed last week's live show that Victor and I did, that is Talking Metal episode 423. This will most likely be episode 424, maybe 425, depending on how I stagger things here. What's going on with Mars Attacks real quick before we go, Victor?
Sure.
Victor has his own podcast, guys. It's called Mars Attacks. If you don't subscribe to it, do so now.
Yeah, we have an interview with Brian Tichy coming up. We have the next classic albums column, which should be up next week, which I guess I'll let the cat out of the bag. That will center upon Iron Maiden's Power Slave. And after that, we have John Oliva queued up for an interview. Was a lot of fun. It was the first time I ever spoke to John, and it was funny because they called me up and the entire interview was done via webcam. So I have to see if they'll allow me to release the webcam version as well. But he was really funny. And
do you like his new record? A lot of people seem to like it. It's on my stack of CDs to listen to. I haven't checked it out yet.
I was surprised. You know, I'm not the biggest Sabotage fan. And, you know, they said that a lot of it was a 70s sort of progressive feel, and I'm not a big 70s progressive guy either, but I could really hear the influence of The Who in there. There's, you know, stuff that's really heavy. There's stuff that's, you know, more operatic. There's or operatic, however you say it. There's, you know, acoustic stuff. There's a little of everything, and I think it's cool. And this is one of the things that I mentioned to him, that after doing the 25th anniversary of the Hall of the Mountain King, he could have easily done another, you know, Sabotage-sounding album, which is his bread and butter, but instead he decided to do an album that really sort of showed another side of him and another side of his influences. And he essentially says that they wrote 70 songs in the process, so that there could be a bunch of other solo albums that come out, you know, during the course of the next few years. So. I recommend the album. If you haven't heard it, you know, at least give it a spin and see what you think.
I will check it out for sure. And guys, keep up with us on Twitter. I'm at Talking Metal, and I also have the Striegel name, two handles. And of course, just use Talking Metal as your hashtag too. That helps out. And we'll keep the discussion going there. Victor is also on Twitter, and Victor is his own site too, MarsAttacksRadio.com. So check him out there. And support your podcast. Make a PayPal donation on either TalkingMetal.com or MarsAttacksRadio.com. Use our Amazon links. Buy the music you hear in today's show by using those iTunes links on Talking Metal. You guys haven't been using those much since I've brought them back, so I would love it if you could use those. They're awesome because they open your iTunes, and even if you don't buy the song that you know the link clicks to, you can then search whatever you want in iTunes, and I get a little kickback on that. So support any way you can. We got Talking Metal t-shirts too. They're for sale in the store section on TalkingMetal.com.
Cool. So I guess we'll wrap things up now, since we're going with the 90s theme and since Metallica's about to release a 3D movie.
Yeah. Hey, before you mention the 3D movie, quick question for you, Victor.
Yeah. I have an 800 number set up.
Yeah, let's maybe, you know, I know we're still in the testing phase here, I don't know what the word is. Yeah, testing phase, trial stage of these live shows. But maybe next week we try taking a couple phone calls.
Okay. And actually, let's do this. If anyone wants to leave a message for us during the week, because this will go directly to voicemail and we will have the ability to play them back, the toll-free number is 888-920-2473. So if anyone wants to give us a shout out during the week, feel free to do so.
Cool. Guys, thanks for listening.
Absolutely. This is Metallica. The name of the movie that's coming out is Through the Never. And this is the track off the Black Album, Through the Never. See you next time on Talking Metal Live.